Netflix presents Inside Joke, Space Force. I'm your host, Jimmy O. Yang. Grab your exoskeleton and BB guns and let's go inside Space Force. Welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking about episode 105, Space Flag, of Netflix's Space Force, written by Brent Forrester and directed by Dee Reese. Armed with weapons that are less than intimidating, Space Force soldiers, led by General Nair, play war games with their Air Force rivals.
Question, if we win all the events based on science and computing, do we really need to compete in lunar laser tag?
Oh, absolutely. The skirmish is worth 100 points. The rest of the contest is worth, I don't know, let's say 30.
So, in other words, it basically boils down to a slap fight on the moon.
It's a skirmish. Skirmish.
Our guests today are head writer and the writer of this episode, Mr. Brent Forrester, and director extraordinaire, Dee Reese. And joining us later will be our location manager, Kyle Suker. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Jimmy. What's going on? Hey, Brent.
What's up, Jimmy?
So the first season of The Writer's Room, Brent, was there, like, how did you guys find that balance between comedy and the grand settings?
It's a back and forth. You know, the writer's room is always a place of tremendous trial and error. And even the tone in the first season, you know, you're inventing a thing that does not exist. And mm-hmm. in season two, you can go, oh, we're making that again. But in this one, you know, we talked about tone a lot. You've got Greg and Steve coming out of The Office, which is the great naturalistic TV show of all time, right? Mm-hmm. But this show did not want to be that. It resisted it. It wanted always to be bigger. And you have to go with that sometimes. The show we talked about a lot, and I'm sure Dee had these conversations too as a director, was Dr. Strangelove came up a lot as a possible tone for this kind of show. Mm-hmm. But it's trial and error, yeah.
Yeah, because usually when you talk about tone, you have a comp. Right? Like, oh, this show is going to be like The Office, or this show is going to be like The Simpsons, Strangelove. But this, I think we created our own tone. It is visually even much bigger than Strangelove at the end of the day. And it's not like The Office at all. So it's pretty cool. Hopefully in the future, people will look at, oh, it's going to be the next Space Force. Dee, how did you get, how did you get involved in this?
I was going to say, like, even like going back to the idea about tone, like even like on the page, it's like you're trying to figure out how seriously the characters are taking themselves mm-hmm. versus how weird the audience are reading them. So it's like this double layer thing. And then talking to Greg, I was like, oh, no, they're like serious as shit. Like they're like earnest, you know. And then, you know, Mallory's kind of like the side eye, kind of like askance, like POV. But yeah, but I met Greg in Greece, like randomly.
Wow.
We were at this like Oxbelly lab. And like we're just there, like, you know, like mentoring other filmmakers.
What's
and
an Oxbelly lab?
So it's this lot. It's about oxbellies, and so you go and you talk about bison. No, okay, it's the, you know, it's like this lab in like Greece where this guy Christos like founded to like basically get Greek filmmaking going. And so yeah, I went there and hung out. It's like you hang out like on a resort basically.
Wow.
And talk about films. It's insane.
And yeah. It's a free it's like, paid for vacation.
Basically, yeah, Willem Dafoe is there, Greg was, it was like this whole cool little group. And so like, that's how we met. And we didn't talk about Space Force then. And then like a couple months later, I got an email like, hey, are you interested? And I was like, yeah, of course. So yeah, man.
Yeah, because you came from like the big feature film world, Mudbound, Bessie, yeah. Great films. And you directed some TV stuff, Empire, and a lot of other stuff. Do you find it challenging to go from the film scope to a TV scope?
Not necessarily. Like, it's all acting. It's all the same. For me, the reason to do this was, like, Steve Carell, John Malkovich. For me, as a director, I'm like, interested in, like, actors. So it's like, where can I play with cool actors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so with, like, last thing, I was like, okay, Anne Hathaway, Ben Affleck, Steve Carell, John Malkovich. I'm always going for, like, work on somebody I haven't done before. And, like, with, like, the other TV stuff I've done, it's like, there's no reason to do episodic unless you're getting to like play with a new toy.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this, like the new toy was VFX. The new toy is comedy. I'm like, I've never even fucking done comedy. Like, how does it even work?
Yeah. So how did you approach it? I mean, did you just storyboard all this stuff? Do you visualize everything? How did you play into the comedy? Because I think, not to knock any other directors, I think we had a great group of directors in season one.
Yeah.
But you gave us some of the most thoughtful acting notes, which you rarely get in TV, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, with comedy, I mean, for me, it's like, you guys have it. Like, to me, like, you guys know the characters more than I'm ever going to know the characters. So like, I'm not going to try to like give you like deep character notes. It's just like about each scene, like how to try to come at it unexpectedly. And honestly, the hardest part was like, you guys give so much. It's like, I'm like, come on, make the show an hour because there's so many other performances and so many other pieces. I'm like, they could have done that and that and that. So it's just kind of, honestly, in comedy, it's like timing. I'm realizing it's really like getting like a wider frame. Because so much of the humor is like in the reaction. So it's like letting somebody say something and not having to cut to the reaction, like letting it all like ping pong, like in the same fucking frame. So honestly, just like letting you guys take it and just like figuring out like where to put the camera to make it cool.
And you did a great job of making it cool. And also, if I may try to elaborate on that, is you have some very interesting coverage, because I think TV so much you just worry about just standard coverage, but you really have interesting coverage. And so many times I didn't even know, oh, that was my coverage, but oh, I did it. And that felt kind of freeing, because I was like, oh, shoot, I wasn't even worried about how I look, because I was just natural acting and reacting as if it was a play. Did you do that intentionally, so you don't make the actors nervous?
I mean, I was just trying to like just figure out like what's important in the frame, or what's like whose scene is it, you know, and figure out what's important about it, and then like compose it so that they get it, you know. So like when you and Naird are doing like the rundown of like what the games are, what the space war is, and like you're like, or Space Flag, and you're like explaining like pants, you're like Iron Man pants. It's like you're kind of like explaining to Rose of Nimwitz, like, how's it gonna work? And so then the funniest thing was then like keep the Nimwitz in frame at all times, because you see they're talking to like a brick wall, you know, in a way. So yeah, just shit like that. And like in like your in like the kind of computer room, it was like, okay, everyone's like looking up, like you want to get that angle, like looking, all these little faces like looking up at you, and you in charge of it, like you're driving like the Enterprise, you know. So it's just like that kind of stuff.
That room is hard to keep fresh, because it's scientists sitting. We had the same problem on Silicon Valley, like I think early on. It's like, how do you make computer nerds coding an exciting show, right? But I think there was some really interesting coverage. And then as fast as you zoom to the desert scenes, which I wasn't there those days, I heard it was grueling.
It was painful. It was a painful shoot. It's like, do all this in 8 hours, go, you know? And we had 2 days. But I mean, just because actors were into it, everybody was excited. You're in your little fucking balloon vest and bobbling around.
Dee, that, I remember when you came and you had shown us where the space flag was going to take place. And it was totally you. You were like, it would be in this sand bowl. And I remember just going, oh, this is fantastic. And you know, that's just you as an artist, because they handed you a project, you created that, and it's the signature of the show. I was going to say that the common denominator with UD and, you know, Carell and Greg Daniels and The Office and Jimmy and Malkovich, it's authenticity, really. It's that's because that's the signature where D comes out. Sorry for being a D Reese nerd, but I just am. I love great directors, and you know, D was at Tisch, right? And made this and was working for Dr. Scholes, right? The freaking people who make the insult for you, right?
What?
She learned filmmaking, making like ads for Dr. Scholes.
Oh, wow.
And then she makes this movie Pariah, which is fucking beautiful. You watch 4 minutes of it on YouTube and you'll cry. It's so good. It's so authentic. It's just D takes her craft and turns it on herself, basically. It's autobiographical. Spike Lee finds D.
Well, he taught at NYU. Yeah. He totally taught there. I got him like redress of the script. But yeah, it was just like about figuring out how to make stuff with like not a lot.
Amazing.
By the way, Brent, I'm going to fire myself after this episode and you're going to host a podcast. You're so good. This is so great.
Watch this. I read your autobiography, Jimmy. And I'll say, you're talking about authenticity. This dude comes from Hong Kong, right? Read his book. Oh, God, it's so good. How to American. Oh,
thank you, Brent. Oh, my God. Thank you.
Jimmy was a champion ping pong player.
Under 13, yes. Yes, now I can't play for shit no more.
And was famous. You were famous, right? You were a famous kid.
I was on TV. And when you get on the local news in Hong Kong, it's a city state. So 7 million people. You're famous, man. So they called me back to do a cable interview. And I was killing it. You know, I just had it. As a kid. I've lost it since I became an adult. Yeah, but this podcast is not about me. It's about you.
Yes.
And Brent, how did you guys come up with this idea, first of all? Like, is this a real thing that the military does? And what about all the technology also? Is that real?
Okay, great question. So, you know, we're talking here about comedy and this art form. And there's this paradoxical element that the more realistic you start out, the better. And so you always want to try to start with something real, start with research. And we fought a little against the bigness. But as I say, the show wanted, especially in the visuals, to be a little bigger. So it does start real. It starts with Greg's obsession with the military industrial complex, basically. He's legitimately afraid of the thing we should be afraid of, which is when billions of dollars are available, that can corrupt shit. And it's gnarly when it gets corrupted in the world of war, because you basically have a motivation to create super killing machines, right? So it starts there. I personally, as a writer, I always like it when you hand me an episode where there's like a competition, because those episodes always go great. It's like this side versus this side. And you always know, you know, when it ends. And
there's stakes. There's escalation. There's an ending. Look, D, I don't know if you know this. Brent teaches a brilliant writing class virtually right now. And I am a student of Brent's.
That's right.
I think in the last class, you talked about how like the Office basketball episode and everything. Competitions just have a built-in stake.
Yes, and a built-in structure.
Yes, built-in structure.
That's true. It's like you know exactly like where the climax is going to be. But then the thing that's cool about this is like the emotional thing that's happening, because Naird and Mallory, it feels like it's where they first kind of cement, you know, this like next level esprit de corps. And You got some gooey emotional thing happening, and like, you know, this kind of climax like cements that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's what you as a director brought out. And that's the spine of it for sure. It's like, you got to put something emotional in it. And we knew that the go-to relationship was going to be, you know, Steve and John. They're like our two, you know, legends. So that was fun.
They're like two poles, and all the other Space Force team is like being pulled between them. They're like,
right. And by the way, tonally, I'm thinking of you, D, because this one was really interesting tonally. Okay. So when you talk about comedy, you know, this Greg coined this phrase on this episode where he said, we have to find the balance between the plausible and the comical. And I was like, I immediately wrote it down in my little notebook, right? It was when we were looking at those balloons, right? Yeah. And we changed the color of the balloons at the last minute to black. It was like, at first you're like, you can't put balloons, that's crazy. But no, if they're black and they're small and it's just plausible enough, but it is fucking absurd.
Yeah, except fuck Tony's. His is white and says press on it, right? That cracked me up.
It was great, yeah. It's like just shy of Fruit of the Loom, you know? So fucking cool.
So are exoskeletons a thing? Like, is that a real thing that you found from the military visor?
Yeah, they and literally for that purpose. Like, I mean, it's so expensive for so little benefit. It's like, if you have to march 20 miles, you'll be 10% less tired, you know?
Right.
They're real.
Just ride a bicycle at that point.
Right. You know?
But it's so interesting because it's very grounded. I think when people watch this, it's like, oh, these techs can totally be usable. And then, of course, when they bring out the knives and the little pokey things, you're like, oh, it would be like this. So Air Force, I guess, with other military branches, this is actually a thing. They practice against each other, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. This is not unreal. And Space Flag is what that is called when, like, Army plays Navy in a war games, you know. Yeah, they call it Space Flags. That was the name of this episode. Yeah,
I didn't know that Space Force was a thing until the show. Like, I read it's like, oh, haha, this is funny. It's like, no, it's real.
One of my favorite moments is when Mallory shows up at the end with the umbrella and the poncho. Whose idea was that?
I think that was Dee's idea.
I don't know, man. I think it's scripted. My the Save the Bees sticker and like the Midnight Special, like that was me. and the Kalima Shakti Day shit.
But oh,
I
mean, yeah.
I think
yes.
On the poncho, it's like, it made sense because it's like, you know, BB repellent, the umbrella. I think that was all you, Brent.
Thank you. Well, yeah, we had a good writing staff there, and we, you know, we had good suggestions flying in. I don't know who's that was, but yeah, those visual things really work. I've often felt that in the realm of the visual, you're actually somehow allowed to be a little more exaggerated. You know, it goes back to this tone issue where if it's too big, it's silly, right? And silly isn't funny. And that's when you embarrass yourself, where you literally think you made a good comedy and then you play it and you're like, oh my God, what have I done? And it happens, right? So the cure for that is just realism, naturalism, try to ground it. But then, you know, you poke out and with a little trial and error, see where you get. But the umbrella with the sound and everything of the pellets hitting it is a good joke.
It's great. Yeah.
I think we can put the most ridiculous things on John Malkovich, and him being so amazing, he can ground everything.
Yes.
Yeah, he pulls it off with a plume. I just like the music. Like, for me, like, I wanted to have that, you know, the old NFL film sound.
Yes.
Just all that gridiron music. Da, da, da. Yeah, exactly. So that was the thing I love about it, putting it, like, because it gives a seriousness, but then it makes it actually ridiculous. So it does two things, because it's like they're taking it very seriously, but then it also feels insane. And, like, all the slow-mo in the war was, like, it just made it more hilarious. And, like,
for sure.
It slowed down, like, the hilarity of, like, the deaths and, like,
Yeah.
Great.
No, that music gag, by the way, is great. And it reminds me, I never think to use sound for comedy, but that's a great example of it.
Our composer's wonderful, Carter Burwell. That adds so much. The cuts you saw, did you see the composer music on it already?
I did. I saw it because I remember in the rough cut, like I kind of gave notes about the music and sending like references. So it was like, it's that old grainy NFL films music.
Yeah.
And then I guess they like did that and then it just totally works. Like the opening scene where it's da 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 and we're like panning down this row of soldiers. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like sets the stakes and then like the kind of soldiers keep breaking it, you know, like Naird is like, that's what he's hearing like in his head. And then when they're like, oh, but it's hot and I'm tired, then they like are breaking it, you know? So yeah.
Can I just pause and say, how lucky are we that we have D as a filmmaker here in our little sandbox? I mean, you know that D's best work is still ahead of her. My God, I can't pick up a newspaper without reading about D riffing with Santi Gold making something. I want to watch this movie now that you're out making. And then people are going to look back and go, hey, you know, D Reese, the Steven Spielberg of her generation, she made a Space Force. That's what people are going to say.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be like, I can't believe I got to work with like Malkovich and Carell, like in the same scene. Like, what the fuck? Like, that's like dream.
How was it directing Steven Malkovich? I think it's so interesting in episode one of this podcast. Steve was telling me, because, you know, my first day, I was intimidated. It was Steve, Greg, everyone. It was Malkovich. And I was just trying to act cool. And Steve was saying he was intimidated by Malkovich, too. So as a director, how do you give those two legends some notes?
I mean, honestly, just give them space. Because I feel like, you know, with comedians especially, I feel like comedians are more self-critical than, like, anything anyone else could ever say. And so it's more like it's the opposite. It's more like, no, that was great, but you know, do you want to try something else? So it's more just giving you guys like more leeway because you instinctually know that wasn't it, or oh, I want to do this other thing.
Yes.
So this is more just about giving you guys time and giving you like the extra takes. So it's honestly just like staying out of the way and like honestly just helping the camera tell the story that you're trying to tell. Because I mean, you guys already know, and you beat yourselves up like instantly. And so it's like
we are very self-deprecating and self-judgmental. Yeah. That is so true, because nobody on this show, but I've worked with some previous directors that's trying to do too much, right? After every take, trying to give you some notes, trying to give you some line reading.
Yeah.
But really, you just got to let us play, because we know we fucked up. And by take three, okay, we got a good one in, and now we can play around. And that's where really some of the magic comes from.
Comedians are dark, man. You guys have like such darkness in you. So I'm always just looking like, how can I hit that darkness vein, you know, or get it in there? So it's like a little, and you know what I mean? Like, that's the main thing I'm going for. But yeah.
And I think one of the prime examples was, I have a few little scenes in this episode, but when I was looking on the satellite battles, you know, on the screen, I was like, and that's a moment when you really see Chan get loose, jumping on Vandeveld, like, you know,
swag,
Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
That was fun. That was cool. And I love what you did, D, because you're like, man, he's kind of like the cool one. Maybe everybody got headphones on, but he doesn't.
Yeah,
which
exactly,
even
yeah.
For me coming in, I was like, okay, I'm just going to play the straight man scientist. Sure, I want to add layers. But those are the kind of little things that adds layers to the character.
Yeah, no, it's like everybody, and like the thing to play with, and it's like everybody has like authority like differently. And so I like Chan, like in his authority, like he knows, you know, he doesn't have to like let you know that he knows, but he just has this kind of calm swag about him. Mm-hmm. And then Mallory's authority is this more like encyclopedic, you know, I'm going to run down for you the moon and actually, you know, a BB tear is all we need to simulate and like make you feel stupid kind of fun. And then Maird's authority is in like the pomp, it's in the uniform, it's in the posture, it's like, it's in the voice that, you know, Steve created this like voice. And so it's like interesting, let everybody wear their authority like differently and like let them have it. And like Tawny's is in like this, like, I'm going to pilot this plane. It's like in like, this work ethic, it's this know-how. And like, F. Tony. It's like, it's like this kind of like emotional oiliness, you know? So he has this kind of slick, I guess, is he supposed to be like Kushner or Kushner-esque? I don't know, but it's less kind of like wormy. I don't know. So it's like letting everybody have their kind of superpower and like, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Did you watch any movies to like war movies and stuff to figure out how to shoot, you know, a little war film?
No, but it's funny. Oh, you know what? Apocalypse Now. So it's like, how can you make this like dusty Apocalypse Now, like real like chaos, you know? Like, and so Apocalypse Now was like the thing. Uh-huh. And then like Kelly, who's our first AD, was amazing. And so we put together this like shooting like strategy of like, okay, here's the imagined action, kind of like football plays. Uh-huh. And then like, what does that mean in terms of where we have to be like in the shooting day and staging and all that?
Kelly, that's the part where it was so fascinating to run into you during your prep. It was the physicality. Okay, so the little filmmaking that I've done, what I feel is it's like it's a confrontation with physical reality, right? It's like, hey, this is a neat thing I just envisioned. Now let's go out in the physical world. Is there a place that looks anything like this? Not really. You know, okay, so how do we adapt? You know, is there electricity that we can plug in? All that shit. But you had figured out like what we never knew on the page, which was like, where are the humans? What are they doing? It was really like a little playpen for you where you had obstacles and where they would be hiding. And it was quite interesting. And I wonder, because I think for directors, this must come from a very deep place. It's not like you get to do this often enough that you go, okay, this is my how to film a war in a sandbox playbook, right?
Yeah.
It's just a series of like attitudes and processes that you bring to it. Is it something like that?
Kind of, yeah. So it's like for the opening, it's like, Space Force is like scared, you know, so they're going to start bunched behind a rock, you know, so it's like the first story is like Space Force not ready, Air Force is ready. So Air Force is like spreading the frame, we're swooping toward them, and Space Force is like static and they're like all like huddled up. So it's like playing with that. Then there's like the whole story of like Obi and Julio. So it's like you break like in like mini stories. And then there's like the I'm forgetting Tani's character's name, Tawny and
Ali.
And so then there's like that kind of story where they're trying to one up each other. And so like when you break the space battle down, like these are these little mini battles happening on this one big field. And, you know,
how choreographed was that? Were you like Vince Lombardi drawing out plays like this character goes this? Because we had a lot of stunt people and stunt coordinators on there too.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I had these dividers, you know, that have like scene, like, you know, like legal dividers, like the scene numbers. And then I drew my little oval, my little bad drawings, and I had my little barriers. And so it's totally like they're about here, they're there. Then they go from this thing to this thing. And, you know, Air Force is coming this way. So no, it's totally like, it's overplanned, honestly. I think, you know, after we got to like take 20, it's like, okay, like fuck the plan, like let's just like stories. But it was like overplanned, but you kind of need it because on the day we're hot, we're spread out, it's sandy,
right?
they're in like balloon vests. But honestly, shooting the command center was just as hard. You still got to get these different positions, different reactions, like walking people back. So neither was easier. Like, honestly, that fucking command room was just as hard as, you know, the field. So it was like,
You hear that, Tawny? I don't care if you're hot. It was hard work in the command room in a studio with air conditioning, man.
It was like hot, man. And like you're figuring out like where the lines are, like where the relationships, like where does Mallory need to be relative to you? Like where does our guy... who's the guy who's like the mole? Or wait, can we say on the podcast?
Yes,
Yuri.
Yuri. Wait.
Oh, Baxter.
Baxter. Yeah. It's like, where's Baxter relative to, you know, seeing this? So it's like, you know, you're trying to create all these lines between the characters so that then you put them over there, you can like start to like connect them, like just like on the battlefield. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think you brought up one of my favorite relationships of this episode is the Kiki and Angela Ali thing. She is so capable, but then you got this one other badass that's checking her. How did that all come about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, like, so like when I read that, it seemed like about like emotional intelligence. And so Angela is super like technical, super buttoned up, whatever. But it's like the relational thing is like her next step to being a leader. Mm-hmm. And then Kiki's character had like that already. She had that kind of like, she knows how to like relate to people. So she can like relate to F. Tony, even when he's telling a bad joke about bitches. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She knows how to like fire a gun. Like
she seems like she's been there, done that. She's battle tested. And Angela is like the A student in school.
She's got the theory. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like me playing ping pong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's the great Funky Johnson.
Yes, so good.
Kiki's played by Funky. Yeah. Oh man, like we love Funky so much. We really created, you know, a part for her. She's not really in the main cast, but we just loved her so much in the auditions.
Oh, is that how it worked? Who did she audition for? Did she audition for Angela in the beginning or something?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh. She was a contender for Angela for sure.
She auditioned for you, Jimmy. She was
for Dr. Chan. Yeah. She was this close.
I mean, nobody could beat Tawny. Tawny was just, she's just got star power in that role for sure. But we just wanted to create something for Punky Johnson, who, if she's listening, please call my agent. I will do the Punky Johnson show in 4 seconds if you ask
me. Wow. Hey,
Punky, yeah.
That's
We're
it.
Supposed to talk, man.
I love Punky. Great. She's a great comedian. She's a stand-up.
Yeah, she's a real original voice. And there's just something about her presence I love.
Yeah, like you want to be around her. And like that was what was cool about your script is like you want more of this like budding friendship, you know, like where is this going to go, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were so cute together.
Yeah, they can learn a lot from each other. It's good. Like you want to put them in a helicopter together and like just like record.
Oh, that there's an idea somewhere. And yeah. D, you directed this one and of course the next one. I don't want to give too much away. So one of my favorite relationships is me and Fuck Tony's, you know, in the next episode. And there was just so much comedy of that. So Brent, maybe you can speak to this also. And D, what was the ideation of that? How did you guys come up with like, okay, let's let these two hang out?
You know, we just knew it'd be funny to put Jimmy and Ben together. And your guys' energies are so opposite. And immediately that was funny, right? You know, what Dee was capturing with you in your brainstorming scenes where just the hilarious, unimaginative, straightforward guy and the way over the top, you know, dude.
I was reading the script, which I'm not very used to. I'm like, Ben, so the comedy is I'm not funny here. So I got to try to be not funny at all.
That's right. Straight man. But it worked. I really thought that was the beauty of that relationship. You guys nailed it in the first, you know, frame.
Oh, and at the end it was so sweet about you know him giving Tony a piece of cheesecake. They complete the arc because in the beginning I remember one of the notes you gave me, D, was like, hey, don't even look at him. You don't want to you don't want to waste no time on this guy when he's asking for ecstasy. So I didn't even look at him when I'm shaving that aloe plant, and then at the end completely comes around. We become like really sweet buddies. I love that moment.
Oh, that was amazing. All of you, D, I remember the shots you used, and I wonder if this was if you'd ever shot a scene this way, because of course the thing of directing TV is this ticking clock is just crushing you, right? You don't have time, and you'd love to get 100 shots. And at one point, and this was the last shot of an exhausting day, and I was like, how is she gonna do this? And you were like, camera here, camera here. And I was like, what? How? And then you got like the three. You had them both facing camera, which was so smart.
Right. So you get one.
Is that a setup you'd used before?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's like the indie film thing where you get like the 90 degree the cameras up and you can get both. And like for Tony, because his energy is so like frantic and like moving, it's like it's nice to have him like constantly panning the frame and wiping the other shot. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, Dr. Chan is like solid, steady, you know, static, like not moving. So then the combination of them makes it like dizzying where it's like steady, pace, and nervous energy. And like F. Tony, like part of the arc, like you're saying, it's like, I feel like I read it as, you know, he goes from going to get over on Dr. Chan, like he's totally going to take an idea and then use it and like climb on him. Mm-hmm. So actually through the course of the badness, they actually are on the team. You know what I mean? By the time they're getting like yelled at with their you know, with the gift they've chosen.
That was my favorite. One of my favorite scenes was the two shot with me and Tony pitching to SecDef. That was so fun. And it's so loose when you can get just a two shot, you know, without worrying, because you can now play off of each other.
Exactly. You know? And you guys are actually a team. Like, you're actually like, it's like, mm-hmm. you're like Chan is into it now. This thing.
Yes.
Like, back from his career, he's like, no, this could work for me. Like, this is good. And like, you know, Tony goes into used car salesman mode and it's like, great.
Yeah. And Brent, with Chan, there's a few moments, which I love, was like the little OCD cutting the cheesecake in exactly 27 pieces. I think that's what the script said, right?
Yes.
3x9, 27 pieces.
Greg Davis pitched that specifically. And it was like, Greg went into his own OCD brain for that beat.
Does he cut cheesecakes in 27 pieces?
No, but he can access that part of his mind. He's definitely a guy who can do that if necessary.
I loved it. And even as an actor, I know I'm talking a little bit about episode 6, but since we have you guys here, as an actor, it calmed me down. It was meditative, which I'm sure is for Chan.
Wow.
But for me also, I have, I guess, mild ADD when I was cutting it, because now you focus in on the act of it and then the dialogue becomes second nature. Huh. You know, you're not worrying about how you deliver in the words, which I thought was such a gift for an actor.
When that prop first came out, remember the first version that came out? It was like a Rubik's Cube. Oh. I was like, what the fuck?
I felt bad for the prop team. They keep having to reset the cheesecake. And we only had about a few cheesecakes and they have to like kind of paste them together.
Yeah. When it came out, I was like, what is that? I'm like scared.
Prop department almost shut down over the cheesecake. I'm going to tell you right now.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody like take a beat more than, but we were like, no, it has to actually be 27 pieces. And the guy just looks me in the eyes. Like, you just
like dead-eyed. Yeah.
We'll give it a shot, sir. You know? Oh, my God.
So here, we're going to play a little clip. Malkovich actually said in one of the press junket things, it's one of his favorite things, when he sees the Air Force people flipping and doing really nimble stuff outside. Because we hired a bunch of gymnasts, and then we found the Lockheed exoskeleton super bulky. So this is when Mark goes outside and he's having a conversation with Mallory. Let's take a listen.
You picked the wrong exoskeleton on purpose, didn't you?
What?
You couldn't help it, huh? You hate the whole idea of war games, space flag.
Space should be a zone of wonder, not of conflict and death.
No, I don't think that's it at all. I don't think it's a moral issue. I think you're scared. I think that you stink at sports, and a long time ago you decided that if you can't win, you're not going to play.
What are you talking about?
Oh, I can just see it now. Little nerdy Mallory sitting in the nurse's office pretending to have a tummy ache so he doesn't get picked last for basketball.
My father was a diplomat. I went to the American school in Geneva. We downhill skied.
Oh, so you were captain of the ski team, huh?
Fuck you, Mark.
It's so great to see those two stand toe-to-toe. And where that episode, because that was in Act 1, right, Brent? And then to see where that ends up in Act 3, where Mallory comes in and saved the day, it was awesome.
Yeah, you know, we were discovering it as we wrote it. We had to ask ourselves, what are the backstory of these guys? And that's what came out. Private school for Mallory was discovered in this episode for sure.
Yeah, and he talks about it later too, about certain very specific characters in his private school. I love all that specific backstory stuff. And captain of the ski team. And then we actually find out he's actually really good at basketball. Hopefully we see that in action.
Oh, yeah. No, we're talking about putting the basketball hoop up in outside the main little building there. So, yeah, for sure.
I would love to play some hoop with Malkovich. I feel like he'll be great, too, to be honest.
There should be like a patch for that. Like after he wins, like he gets like the space flag patch. There should be like a basketball, I kicked your ass. It's just physics patch. Like, that'd be awesome.
That'd be great. So before we bring in our third guest, I'm a big admirer of both of you. And I asked Greg and Steve, I asked Malkovich, I asked Allison Jones the same question. Brent, like I said, you're a great comedy teacher, not just a great writer, because not every great writer can be a teacher. You know, like Michael Jordan, I'm sure he'll be a terrible coach.
That's right.
But you're honestly so encouraging and you break down everything into tiny pieces. So my question for you is, how did you learn it yourself? Did you have a great teacher like someone like you? And what are maybe some advice for young writers?
Boy, you're coming at me where I live here. You know, I had no talent as a comedy writer. I can tell you that. I was not allowed to watch television in my entire life. My mom hated TV. And so I did not really watch TV until I graduated from college. I my aspiration was to be a short story writer, you know, where the big bucks are there, you know. And I was so lucky. I happened to have a friend in high school whose mom is Susan Harris, who created The Golden Girls. And as I was like, I'll be a journalist. I'll write freaking soap opera, anything. Is there any writing job? And she was the only connection I had anywhere. And she gave me the greatest advice ever for writing and really, you know, for writing comedy, but art in general. She read my terrible first spec script, which was an awful Murphy Brown, which it was so bad. And she read it and she goes, Brown, I'm going to tell you three things. One, silly isn't funny. I was like, what? And because she was in that James L. Brooks, like Gary Marshall, you know, realistic dialogue for
actors.
Which
is ahead of its time at that point.
Right. It's a kind of writing that is the tastemaker-y kind of writing. She said, write the way people talk, which is also like, what? Don't flip the words around and try to make a little clever soup of, you know, you know, SAT words. No, write the way people talk. And then she said, write about what's difficult for you, even painful. And trust that it will come out funny. And I've never heard better. It was the greatest piece of advice I ever got.
That's so true, because so much comedy comes from pain. And I think Steve said this even as an actor. It's like the characters in the show should not know that they're in the comedy. So I guess the lesson here is don't try to be funny. Just try to be real and let the comedy play.
And let it come out funny. I mean, you don't want to police against funny. You know, it'll come out funny. But it's interesting that if you aim at the serious and naturalistic, oddly, it comes out funny if you know you're writing a comedy.
Yeah. And Dee, I guess kind of the same question for you, because you have such a prolific body of work already, film and television. And so many of your stories are so authentic and great. So what do you have, what's your advice for some young filmmakers out there?
I mean, you know what? I'm gonna steal like my wife's advice and use that, because she's a nonfiction writer. And so she kind of taught me, it's like the situation is not the story, you know? So it's like, you know, you can have a great situation, but you may not have a story. So it's figuring out like what that is. Huh. And like, you know, just in crafting scenes, like, if two characters in a room, like just figuring out why they're in the room, like, and the reason can't be circumstantial. It can't be they're in the room because a phone call is happening. It's like anybody can walk away from any conversation at like any time. So if two people are sustaining something, just trying for yourself to figure out like why they're having that conversation, because it can't be that the door is locked. You know what I mean? It can't be like a circumstantial thing, because then you have plot holes and this undoes itself.
So the circumstance, the situation, those are more like complications. Would that be a right way, where story has to be coming from something internal? Because I know, Brent, in your class you broke down what story really means, which is very hard to explain.
Well, you know, we're doing a certain kind of story, half hour storytelling for TV. You can do a very simple formula. There's just not that many pages, right? If it's you do an A, a B, and a C story in 22 minutes, everybody gets about 7 minutes of story, so or a little more in the A story. But, you know, the television episode is well designed for two characters have a conflict that resolves, you know, and that's fun for actors to play always. If you can find some reason for that to happen, it always ends up being the spine of stories. Now, having said that, you know, stories can be infinitely complicated too, and they can start one way and go another way. And Greg is a great one to talk about story with, because he really likes the unpredictable ending. He just loves it when you go, I'm a sophisticated viewer. I do not really know where this is going. He loves that feeling. And you'll notice that in his work. That's the Greg brand, story-wise.
Yeah, yeah. And a great example you're saying is when stories dovetail at the end, like the business school episode in The Office, which was brilliant.
Thank you.
Episode 6 of this, right? It's like the situation is they need to buy POTUS a birthday present, but the real story is, like, you know, Chan wants to prove his value beyond like what people are seeing of him, you know, like Tony wants to like prove like wants to like prove his like alpha. It's like, you know, that like the story is this deeper thing that they're trying to do. Or like episode 5, like the situation is we have this scrimmage or whatever, but the real story is that like Nerd really needs to like believe in himself. Believe in his team. Like that's the story, you know. He needs to learn to trust other people. That's the story. The situation, running around popping balloons, you know what I mean? Like that's, you know,
that's like that a situation and circumstance, and the story is a relatable human story.
It's like self-belief, like self, you know, like, you know. So It's like, mm-hmm. the stakes are higher because if this doesn't work, maybe he's going to resign. Maybe he's going to, like, you know, say, you know what, I can't do it. And, you know, mm-hmm. this rival is better than me. So, like, that kind of shit. Yeah.
That's great. It's so hard to explain storytelling. It's like teaching someone how to cook. And they ask you, so what does tasting good mean? It's like, yeah, you got to make a dish taste good, but I can't explain it. But I think you guys did such a wonderful job. It's going to be great. And now joining our conversation, we got a locations manager, Kyle Suker. Welcome, Kyle.
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, buddy?
Good, man. Where are you at? You in L.A.?
I am in LA. I'm in Santa Clarita. It's where we're based out of. Yeah, broadcasting from my son's room because I've got three little ones.
Kyle, I think for a lot of people that don't know, they think Hollywood's Hollywood. But so many things, especially exterior locations, shoot in Santa Clarita, which is like about an hour away from LA. And there's a few mm-hmm. things in this show that's shot there, right?
Yeah, so we found Mark Nared's base home up there because there's a lot of tract homes which give you the kind of that style that almost feels like it's a military base with similar styles as opposed to.
So the exterior of that house is practical.
It is.
What about mm-hmm. the interior? Is that on the soundstage? No, or?
We shot most of that on location as well. I believe they only built the bedroom on stage, as far as I know. I don't know if any of the interior downstairs was ever built on stage. I know that you're talking about if we had further seasons, they might build more of the house out.
Yeah. And I know my first day of shooting 101, the launch site, that was also in Santa Clarita.
That was. It's a place called Mystery Mesa.
Yes.
Which is a cool kind of view where you have like a 360 of mountains. It's just like a flat desert mesa that overlooks. It's about like 300 feet above like the street right below it. And so there's kind of like canyons that you could see, and it's been in a lot of big movies and TV over the years. So
yeah, so fun fact. Fun fact, I have a little overlap of the last episode, shooting the last episode of Silicon Valley. Or no, uh-huh. the last episode of Silicon Valley airing and then shooting the first episode of Space Force. And in the last season of Silicon Valley, there's an episode called Russ Fest. They built an mm-hmm. entire festival ground called Russ Fest by this character, Russ Hanneman, with Ferris wheels, seatings. It was an incredible production by the set designer. And that was a Mystery Mesa. And then my first day on Space Force was also a Mystery Mesa.
Oh, it was like a deja vu experience.
Yeah, I'm like, this is familiar. It's like going to a soundstage now, you know?
Yeah. It's like you never left.
Yeah. What about the battle scenes for this episode?
For this episode, we went to a place, and feel free to chime in, D. We went out to a place in Simi Valley called Gillibrand Industrial Sands.
Yeah.
It's been around since like the 50s. It's like a sand quarry, and we were in a little spot called Little Pit. I don't know if you ended up using any of the footage too. There was another place that we called the Great Expanse in the back too.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a cool spot. Go ahead, D.
Oh no, I was saying I had shot a Walmart commercial there, and so I remembered it. So we're in the van, like trying to find a place. And it's like, let's go to the fucking sand quarry so we can get like the idea is to try to get like a moon-like environment, you know? Mm-hmm. And then like also like how can you create a stadium in Gillibrand? Let us do whatever we want, and they moved everything around for us. So it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. The guys there are really helpful, and they just recreated whatever D kind of dreamed up. And I do remember specifically, D, when we were scouting that place with you, that you were almost having a little debate with our effects guy of whether you would get your ideal shot. And you even did a little stunt work where you jumped on the top of the van.
On top of the van. Wow. Like, see, you can't see them over the lip. But in the episode, they didn't even like doing like VFX. So I'm like, we didn't even do any VFX in this episode.
It was all practical, even with the gymnast doing backflips.
I know.
Oh, there you go.
They're supposed to be like rockets, like in the background. You know?
Jumped off of that van, D. That's like a 10 feet tall van, maybe more.
No, I climbed like awkwardly up the side of it with like a foot on a mirror or something crazy
or something like that. Yeah,
I was trying to we're trying to figure out how to like basically the original idea was to like extend the set into like a set extension thing, so where the bowl appeared to be like even bigger, mm-hmm. and that was going to be the cut point. Long. Yeah, to pace the horizon. But they didn't know VFX anyway, so now it's just a little bowl. But it's fun though. But
they still kind of got your shot though. It looked like that whole arrival scene with the Air Force popping up, which is cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had fun playing out in the sand out there. I think I have some more shots of her just being her own little army all by herself, trying
sliding
to sell
down the
locations.
Size of the bowl.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think we're still trying to get sand out of our boots from there. But yeah, it was cool. And it was a cool scene to shoot there. I think even the guys at Chilbrin said it was one of the most intense kind of scenes, even though it's not anything blowing up. It's just mm-hmm. small little BBs.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah.
But the locations are so grand and open, which is what made it fun. Yeah. It's up to the own, everyone's imagination. Kyle, I think location managing is such an interesting job to me because it's one of those jobs that you guys do so much work, but the actors, we never meet you guys, you know?
That's right.
So I guess what's the secret sauce of being a good location manager? Is it like, okay, we need this desert scene, and then you already got five locations in your Rolodex in your head?
I mean, that's part of it for sure. And you're always kind of geared up. And a lot of this too, like the hangar that we had in this one,
mm-hmm.
it's actually only been shot once before. It's a newly opened facility that used to be owned by like a Boeing company.
It's in Long Beach, right?
Yeah, they built the C-17s there.
It's so cool.
They built yeah. airplanes in there and it was massive. How many square foot or acre was that?
I think they actually said acreage. It's about 930 acres.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They pumped out like 250 planes out of that place. But yeah, as far as location managing go, it's all kind of, you know, a little help of the internet to try and research some of this stuff. But, a lot of it's just from experience from finding it and just traveling. I mean, that's why scouts are crucial still these days. You can't just pick it off of a website all the time. You have to send people out to scour the lands and find unique things that you normally wouldn't find on an everyday basis.
So is there a website like LA casting for actors for locations? Like, okay, this Boeing plant used to be a plant, but now it's available for shooting.
That one I actually just kind of was researching on, you know, cause we were looking for old military bases that, you know, recently become defunct because the ones that really got defunct a long time ago are not worth shootable. And, mm-hmm. that one kind of just popped up in my research and, it just happened to time out that they had been bought by a real estate company taken over. And, we kind of geared them towards filming and they opened up to it. So it's really cool. And it was a great look for us. It looks awesome on camera just to see the expanse.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Oh, it looks best. Wonderful. I remember that was my only day there.
Yeah.
Me and Mark scene. And I had somebody take I just bought an iPhone 10 and I had somebody mm-hmm. take a wide angle shot of me in the hangar. It was so freaking cool, man. The grandness of it. So it was cool. Great.
Yeah. It's like a mile long. I almost wanted to bring a skateboard or some rollerblades.
Yeah.
You needed to walk to lunch, man. And kind of like sweet talked them because like they didn't want us filming on a certain side of the building.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Boeing still has involvement because they're tearing down some of the buildings and they have to, you know, they basically had to involve their own employees to be the ones in charge of anything that's being dismantled. Probably, I don't know if it's because it's top secret still or what it is. So because of that, they were kind of saying, well, you got to shift you all to this side. But of course, the best spot was
yeah.
right where was right we were there. Well, we got it. We ended up getting it. And yeah, just that's another part of our job as location managers is we're the middleman to try and get what we need, mm-hmm. but also keep them happy, keep us happy and, all commingle and get out of there and get invited back at the same time.
Yeah. It's weird because being on the scout, it feels like buying a house. You don't want to like let them know that you like it too much.
Yeah, you're like a real estate agent.
Oh man, I really like it. I really like it. Oh, but yeah. It's like you can't let them know you like it too much because then they're going to like, okay, here's the price.
You're like, you're in the running. We're thinking about it, but we're still exploring. It's like dating
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, go in there and talk some shit. It's like, ooh, this drawer don't really close right. I don't know,
exactly.
Man. That plug is busted, dude.
I'm going to be discreet on who has said it before, but I've actually been on scouts where we're in this place and director walks in and no offense to director, but went, oh my, this place is a shithole. So the owner's right there.
Yeah.
Keep the shithole down a little bit.
Yeah, you guys are really the relationship managers with these buildings and owners.
Yeah, we're the between the public and in the film crew, we're the kind of in between man. the middleman for sure.
Do you have like the neighbors like hit you up like, oh, give me an extra 100 because you're in front of my driveway? Like,
oh yeah,
that's a thing. Yeah.
Oh, that's a huge thing for sure. It happens more in the wealthy neighborhoods, to be honest. The other neighborhoods that the neighborhoods I like filming in are the ones that need the money because they mm-hmm. enjoy it. It's like an experience for them and they don't get it as often. Whereas mm-hmm. obviously we're always filming in big houses. So, a lot of the neighbors are a little sick of us sometimes, but we try and always, my goal, which I always tell people when they're there, is we want to be invited back. Uh-huh. So we do build a strong relationship with them. So that you become friends throughout the season as well, especially in this case, like we're going to someone's personal residence, Mark Nerd House, are like best friends with the owner now, as far as, so that way they know that they're comfortable having us back and, we're going to take care of them mm-hmm. as well as take care of our crew.
One of the most interesting reoccurring locations in our show is the old Toyota building where John Malkovich works, that where you see him marching out of his office in the lab.
Yeah, the old headquarters.
Yeah, and in this episode too, at the end when they win the war and they're buying Froyo and stuff, So was that kind of like, because it's eerie going in there. You're like, oh man, everything looks kind of 90s in there. And it's really yeah. cool with the spiral staircase. People used to work here, but now it's just a movie set, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's owned by a real estate company now. Toyota packed up and left, I think, Texas, their whole headquarters. So they actually left the whole state a few years back. So I think it's been vacant since like 2017. And then it just started, becoming like a mini backlot because it's got a lot of grounds and a lot of cool, interesting buildings, interior and exterior wise. One thing I kept pitching so many times for our show to make it in there and everyone loved it, but it just never seemed to work. And I don't remember, D, if you went down there, but there's this cool long tunnel that adjoins two of the buildings that's subterranean. Mm. It's like almost like a mile long or something like that. So if we go back for another season, it'd be cool to finally get a scene down there or something like that. I know we almost did it a few times for whatever reason. It was time or money or whatever. We never made it.
It's like, I love the whole like brutalist architecture of the show because all those old mm-hmm. buildings is depressing because it's like this brutalist, like severe kind of feel.
Sharp and angles.
Yeah. And it ties into Space Force because it feels kind of dated, you know, it kind of like mm-hmm. somehow like all the locations like made sense with like the look of the show. It felt like, yeah. Like I think we didn't have that underground thing, but we had the one, what's the, like just off the loading dock that
yeah,
kind of
the little
like
circular, like, floor. Yeah.
Like yeah. that was a cool set where we shot a scene with Brad and you know, he's going down there to the IT department. Like, so it was a lot of cool kind of like phases like that.
Yeah. And they made it in this one with Steve coming out singing in falsetto. I was actually, yeah. I think I was there for that scene. I was trying to bite my tongue because it's hard not to laugh while he's doing his little big girls don't cry.
So good. Was that in the script, D, or was that song chosen after?
No, that was in the script, the cry. You know, it's just about getting like the yay, you know, like, you know, yeah. We just want that, the biggest echoey possible.
So yeah, good. It's a good little character trait for him, for sure.
Well, great, Kyle. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you guys letting me be a part of it, and, little trip to Space Force. It was fun.
Hell yeah. And thank you very much, D. Thank you, Brent. I think this has been a very fun episode, guys.
Thanks. Yeah, man. It was cool.
Take care, guys. Have a good one.
Later, man.
This has been Inside Jokes Space Force. I'm your host, Jimmy O. Yang. Join us again for even more Space Force right here on the podcast.